Welcome to the Michiana Adventist Forum. We're pleased that you came out to listen and participate today. Our program is Seeking a Sanctuary, Seventh-day Adventism and the American Dream, a discussion of the book by Malcolm Bull and Keith Lockhart. As you can see, we've got four Andrews professors here who are going to help us think about the book and contribute their expertise. After they've each made a presentation, they'll have a little panel discussion, and then there'll be an opportunity for you to contribute your questions and get involved in the discussion. As we begin, Clark Rowland is going to offer a word of prayer.
Our Father in heaven, we thank you for the opportunity of gathering together here to think about the way others see us. Guide and direct in our discussion, for we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.
Our next two forum meetings are scheduled for April. On April 5, Dr. Richard Osborne, who is president of Pacific Union College, and before that was vice president for education of the North American Division, is going to be with us talking about challenges facing Adventist higher education. He has done a lot of research and thinking, as you can imagine, on this topic, and he'll be sharing statistics and insights with us about the demographic and economic and cultural and sociological challenges that are facing Adventist higher education. Then 2 weeks later, April 19, Dr. T.J. Willey from Loma Linda will be discussing the background and meaning of Ellen White's statements about the amalgamation of men and animals. His presentation is entitled, A Beast in the Garden, Why Ellen White's Amalgamation Statements Challenge the Unity of Man. If any of you are not getting email notifications and would like to, there are sign-up sheets on the back that you can give us the information so we can add you to the mailing list. And I'd like to again thank Terry Calkins and Debbie Robertson for what they do to help us get the word out about the meetings. Well, our program today is A Mirror of Adventism, discussing the book Seeking a Sanctuary. As you may know, this book was published last year, actually it's the second edition that came out last year, by Indiana University Press. It's a sociological and historical study of principally North American Adventism by two English scholars, a journalist and a sociologist who teaches at Cambridge, I believe. Oxford, eh? Okay, somewhere over there in England. A number of academics, both within the Adventist community and outside, have cited this book as probably the best scholarly source on Adventism available today. I think that any of you that have had the opportunity to read the book will realize that it has an incredible store of information about Adventist history, Adventist culture, Adventist institutions. Having spent most of my life within a few miles of either Berrien Springs or Loma Linda or Tacoma Park, I found the book was just filled with people that I or my family have known or worked with or studied under or been neighbors to or gone to church with or whatever. For I think any of you that are longtime associates of the Adventist North American community will probably have a similar feeling in going through the book. Just of interest, I noted that there are at least eight of the people mentioned in the book that have been forum speakers here with our group in the last several years, so I'm not sure what that means, but anyway, I guess we're on the same wavelength. Well, our panel of scholars today includes Pamela Harris from the Communications Department, Gary Land, Chair of the History Department, Stan LaBianca, anthropologist from the Behavioral Sciences Department, who should say graciously has stepped in at the last minute when Dwayne McBride was called out of town because of a family emergency, and Russell Staples from the Missions Department. They'll each be making a short presentation, or at least until as long as they can before Gary cuts them off, if he's a little worried about the timing, but they'll each make a presentation related to some comments from their area of scholarly expertise, and then, as I say, a panel discussion, and then a sort of open question and answer session, which Gary Gray will be communicating, coordinating.
They asked me to make a few introductory remarks, so I'll do that. I want to thank Gary Land and Pamela Harris. This is their idea, so we thank them for this. These are the books. This is what the 1989 edition looks like, published by Harper and Row. And this is the second edition that was published last year by Indiana University Press. And Art has already mentioned some of these details. The second edition is quite breathtaking, I think, in its scope. Part one is about Adventist theology, what it is, how we came by it. Part two is the Adventist experience and the American dream. It includes how Adventists define happiness, among other things, their emphasis on religious liberty and so on. Part three is the Adventist subculture, and under that heading, they have chapters on race, gender, ministry, medicine, education, and the self-supporting movement. I might make a couple of comments about the authors. Both were raised within the subculture of Adventism. One was baptized at the usual young age, and the other was not. Both of us have attended Adventist schools at least a little bit. And I believe that Lockhart has a master's degree from from Andrews in religion. And it's my understanding, I may be wrong on this, it's my understanding that neither of them at the moment subscribe to Adventists' beliefs. Gary, in our discussions preparing for this, Gary Land came up, I think, with an interesting idea, and that is that these authors bring both an insider and an outsider view to Adventism, meaning that if you read the book, they really seem to know Adventism and know it in its subtle nuances that only an insider can know. And yet they also seem able to step back and analyze the whole picture of Adventism in ways that an outsider could only do. So this idea of both the insider and the outsider view of Adventism. By Keith Lockhart's own admission, a couple of changes from the first edition to the second edition, well, more than a couple. The second edition fills in what has happened since the first edition was published, which means they were doing their research in the early 1980s, so somewhere to the early to mid-1980s, up to the present. And a good example of this is they talk about the David Koresh and the Branch Davidian incident in the second edition, not, of course, in the first edition. There are a number of illustrations, maps, graphics, tables in the second edition. The second edition also includes more discussion of popular culture in Adventism, subjects like music, art, and literature. More statistical material and census data are included. They include more of a discussion of breakaway movements, like the Branch Davidians. They also include more data on the growth patterns within the Adventist Church, especially those that have experienced rapid growth. I think the Caribbean is probably the top of that list, Africa and South America. But they also talk about statistics dealing with the church in Europe and in America, where growth has not been as nearly as rapid. They expanded the chapter on women into a broader discussion of both femininity and masculinity. It's now called gender. And they expand their discussion on race. But Mr. Lockhart hastens to add that they did not change their original thesis. That is, all the new material from that they put into the second edition, they managed to mesh with that original thesis, namely Adventists' complex relationship to America. Well, Art and I had a couple of questions that if the panel, maybe the panel will cover them, maybe you can respond to them, maybe they won't get covered. Maybe some of them aren't worth covering. Is this good history, good sociology, good theology? They sort of take an interdisciplinary approach and mesh all of these disciplines together. And so we could ask, not only are the facts right, but is the methodology sound, but also what those facts mean? Is their interpretation of the facts defendable, accurate, sound, correct, logical, etc.? And not only with the individual disciplines, but with this whole picture that emerges when they are finished. Does the thesis essentially hold? That is, does Adventism in fact develop a parallel world close to, but intended not to touch, the American world? The authors do acknowledge that there is a paradox here, namely that Adventism does develop many of its beliefs and practices as imitations of the larger American society. We all know this, that, you know, Pathfinders instead of Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, Loma Linda and Worthington, food substitutes instead of the real thing. What about the non-North American church, though? Does the thesis hold when some 80% of the Adventist church is outside of North America? Does the American model or image really work for members of Adventism who are not Americans? And as of now, that's a vast majority of the church. Duane was not here. His mother-in-law passed away this week, so he is out of town. We're sorry about that on many levels. Brought a very vigorous presence to our preparation for this, and we're sorry he's not here. But I would quote him on one idea, and that is, Bull and Lockhart described the church as in a passive relationship to American government authorities. They don't want hostility. They defend religious liberty when they have to, but they generally tend to be passive when it comes to government authorities. But what happens when, in non-North American situations, when Adventists are the authority? What does that do to Adventist self-image and to this book's thesis? To whom would you recommend this book? College students? Non-SDA academics, new converts, old cynical liberals, overly sincere conservatives, or is that the other way around? Old cynical conservatives and overly sincere liberals, or no one? Just lock it up and hope that the electronic age sweeps over us all very quickly. How does knowledge of the convoluted history of doctrinal development within the Adventist Church affect how we relate to that doctrine today? Are doctrines like sausage? Are we happier not knowing how they are made? That's not a very good Adventist image, I guess. Would some of you here today who are mentioned in the book, who have first-hand knowledge of events discussed in the book, be willing to comment on how the book's account agrees or disagrees with your own recollections or interpretations? They did a lot of research on this campus, and from our resources here, including our library and our professors. We could say a lot more, but let's stop there and give our panel a chance to talk. We'll start with Russell and proceed from there. How to keep professors down to 8 to 10 minutes is going to be my now pressing problem.
Good, we'll face that. The announcement sent out said, "A mirror of Adventism, question mark." It's the question mark that impressed me a great deal. And it's, I'd ask the same question exactly. I find myself asking, why this book? Normally, you see people write books to defend a cause, a theology, a movement, or else in disagreement of it, to sort of run counter, or maybe just to write a book, I don't know. What inspired this book, and why did they write it? I have a kind of an idea, a thesis that I'll suggest to you. The dominant motif that is here is a sanctuary, seeking a sanctuary. A sanctuary is generally understood as a place of refuge and safety, a place of escape from conflict and avoidance of defilement. Is that the best image of the Adventist Church? And is this sociologically based motif, which portrays Adventists as a sect-like sanctuary of purity, holiness, isolated from the defilements of the wider society, does this adequately capture the dominant themes of Adventism? Or is the dominant portrayal of Adventism would be better be portrayed in a theological motif than a sociological motif? Why this particular motif? And this is where I have an idea. After my sort of missionary aspect in Africa, I came to study in this country. And fairly early on, it was 1968, Professor Brian Wilson came and was giving a series of lectures. He was on his way to Berkeley. And in the course of this, I made his acquaintance. And when he discovered I was an Adventist, he wanted to talk to me, and we had long conversations. And here was a man who was very interested in Adventism. I'd been there about maybe less than a year. I didn't find anyone else around that place particularly interested in Adventism, but Brian Wilson was enormously interested, and particularly so when he discovered I was from Africa. He wanted to know about the church in Africa and were there sects of the Adventist Church, and did I know about the other African sects, the Kimbangu movement, Johanna Meranke, Isaiah Shembe, on and on did what he wanted to know. And he also wanted to know, where could he find out more about Adventism? We are the great resources. And I forgot all about this in due course, but it was quite wonderful to have a man interested like this in Adventism. And then, about four years later, I got a letter from him, and he wanted to come to Andrews to do research. And so in 1972, he came here with one of his Oxford University Press editors to do research about Adventism here. And he spent 2 weeks. And very interesting sidelight. His assistant didn't find there was enough stimulus or whatever it would be about the food here. And he needed a bicycle to get back to the village to get a few more things into his diet, and so I lent him my bicycle for 2 weeks, and I would see him riding back and forth while he was doing this. 1974, 2 years later, Andrews was conducting a centennial celebration of the 100 years of Adventism, and we had over 2 weekends, in fact, several lecturers, and we invited Brian Wilson, and he came. He gave 3 presentations on Adventism. I see some of you will remember that. And these are in the library. Besides, he gave many other talks. He spoke about the sociology of the Adventist Church, 2 lectures, one about Adventist missions, and so on. And then a couple of years later, Roy Branson invited him to do a forum, major lectures at a meeting of the Forum in California. And this last year, I think Bruce Malcolm Bull and Lockhart, they followed his steps and did another forum there. I have here from my library 5 of the 6 of Brian Wilson's books I have, Magic in the Millennium, Sects and Society, Religion in Sociological Perspective, Religious Sects, Religion in Secular Society. There are 3 more in the library. All of these mention Adventism in one way or another. He had set about writing a book about Adventism, and that's why he came here. One of the things that impressed him about Adventism was this upward social mobility and economic mobility, and Adventists in positions of authority, government, political, and various other positions around the world, which didn't fit the normal sect-like process. And he came here to do research to fulfill that. This book wasn't forthcoming. I wrote to him a time or two, didn't get a response. And then I went to visit him at Oxford. It was about 1985 or 86, I don't know exactly. And he told me a sad story. He said that he had taken notes, and he had vast numbers of notes from all around the world. And he wanted to lay all of these out. He didn't have a place large enough, so he'd put them on the floor. They were written in ink. And he said tragedy happened. His hot water heater that heated the thing sprung a leak. It flooded the floor. His notes were gone. And he said, I've abandoned the project. I wasn't sure whether to believe him or not, that he'd abandoned the project. Now, he did abandon the project. Just why, I don't know. He also told another Adventist, Christensen from Sweden, he told him the same story. It may be quite correct. If one reads the acknowledgments in this book, it says, we would like to record our gratitude to a number of people, Jonathan Butler, Roy Branson, Harry Leonard, etc., and in particular to the late Brian Wilson, whose guidance was perhaps more important to us than we realized at the time. I think what we have here in this book is Brian Wilson's work continued, his visions and through, and I think that explains the total approach of this book, the sociological approach rather than the theological approach, the motive for writing the book. At least it explains it for me. Now, you don't have to accept that, whatever it is, but if this thesis is correct, for me it explains a great deal about the book and so on. Perhaps the thesis of the book is revealed in the following statements. Let me just read from page 14. The experience of the Adventist Church is examined in response to the American nation. One of the main developments in Adventist theology, the main events of Adventist theology are chronicled in an effort to define the ideological boundaries between the church and the world, and this is a purely sociological viewpoint, and so on. Another statement from page 109, just a little further on. This concludes the first section which I'm supposed to be addressing on theology. And it says like, the clue as to why Adventism never crosses over into the other lane to broader American society is examined in certain chapters, and that is the belief that America will one day become intolerant. Revelation 13 in the picture that is on this cover. Actually, I much prefer the cover of the older book, which is more moderate. But you can think about that. And it says here, perhaps the most striking aspect of Adventist ideological system, in other words, that America will become a tolerant, the Sabbath issue, has kept Adventists separate from the rest of American society. But the wider division between the church and the republic cannot be fully appreciated without discussion of Adventism as a social discipline from a sociological point of view. In other words, the thesis that divines and keeps us as a separate sect, according to this book, is this belief that the Sabbath tension that will happen, Revelation 13, that thing. And this is reflected and I think colors the whole book that is here. Certainly there's validity and much to be gained from careful sociological analysis. But does the sociological motif of the sanctuary theme adequately capitalize and give expression to the dominant features and thrust of Adventism? No model adequately covers every feature of a movement. But does this theme tend to overemphasize a sect-like movement retreating into its safe enclave and downplay the outward thrust and sense of mission that have turned the Adventist Church into a major world body? Perhaps it is not surprising that there is frequent reference in this book to the anomaly of Adventism. It doesn't fit just every category. We are a very important movement, it says, a major world movement in many countries, becoming almost the one of the larger bodies, larger churches, the anomalies. Would it not be more appropriate to build on a theological rather than a sociological motif in seeking to portray the defining characteristics of Adventism? I would suggest that the organizing principle of Adventist theology is a highly eschatologicalized great controversy theme in which the church is called to play a part in bearing witness to the entire world of a victorious and returning Savior. It would seem from both a theological and sociological point of view that this much broader motif, which portrays defining concepts of God, of the way of salvation, and of the role of the church in the fulfillment of God's purposes for humanity in the world, would better characterize Adventism than that of withdrawing into a sanctuary. Certainly, there are beautiful aspects of a sanctuary model that are applicable to Adventism. The concept of a loving and supporting community in which truth is treasured and protected, which attracts friends into its midst and gives them support, which seeks to reach out in ardent witness and so on and so forth. But is it adequate? Now, coming to part one, 88 pages, 6 chapters on Adventist theology. This is the shortest section in the book and the one I seek to address and so on. Generally speaking, rather than tracing a central theological development, it's what has happened along the side. There's a great deal of very interesting information, well documented, all, I think, accurate, and so on. But it works along the peripheries, the byways, rather than tracing what I would call the central highway. The first chapter is called Authority, and it traces discussions about what is the greatest source of theology in the Adventist Church? Is it scripture, reason, or is it really the prophetic word of Ellen White? Let me read you page 37. Adventist theology is defined as a process in which reason, prophecy, and scripture are constantly battling each other for priority. Today it would seem that the visions of Ellen White have prevailed over the competing imperatives of the other two sources. I leave you to think about that. This is not to say the demands of the Bible, but the church's sources of authority are always interchanging. It is this phenomenon, as much as anything else, that allows Adventism constantly to redefine itself with undermining its identity. I have a sort of a question mark on the side here. I leave you to judge that. I would think really that we have a major view of scripture which has dominated, and I don't see three always battling each other for sources. There have been struggles along the way, but I think that's not the big picture. In the Adventist chapter on Adventist identity, the history of the Adventist Church is traced. Again, a great deal of very interesting history here, but it's what is missed that interests me a great deal. Our sort of origins, much is said here of what our Christian Connection brethren, going back to the Disciples of Christ, the Christian Church, Alexander Campbell, and others, the Bible only, and therefore the Trinity in question, possibly some aspects of Arianism, and so on. Things like that are given very considerable weight here. But the main highway and stress, mention is made of the Millerite movement. However, this is not located as a dominant force within the major Second Great Awakening, which shaped it. And some reference is made to Methodism, but not to the other. They close the identity chapter with this statement, rather than to the structure of Adventist beliefs and practices. And so it is here. We have Adventists who have enormous, yes, we have a strong sense of identity, but enormous sort of fidelity and allegiance to the organization rather than to the fundamental beliefs of the church. There may be some truth to that, as I found myself weighing it up, but is it an adequate statement? If it does, it certainly challenges us in many directions to think of this. At least for me, yes, the church is very important, but what we believe, the way of salvation, is more important. One of the major things in this chapter, particular chapter, is that it does not build adequately on the fundamental structure of Wesleyan Arminian theology. But I see the clock, and I better not say too much about this. The end of the world, eschatology, is mentioned, but not enough is done to give the profound weight of the eschatological interpretation of the church, the meaning, the sense of purpose. One of the things that Wilson wrestled with is our sect-like aspect in some ways, but yet this outreach, this enormous sense of outreach that has made us a world body. And this is very much dealing with the American dream, because there is very little sect-like about the Adventist Church in many places in the wider world, as it is here. Chapter 6 is on the development of Adventist theology, and there are many facts all along the way. The big picture, which I would say the big sort of defining characteristics, are not really given adequate weight. I should close with a statement with which we opened here. That's not my book. The reason Adventism never crosses over into the other lane lies in the Adventist belief that America will one day become intolerant. This is the culminating statement of the section on theology. Perhaps the most striking aspect of Adventist ideological system, and they don't say theology, ideological system, has kept Adventists separate from the rest of Adventist society. But the wider division between the church and the republic cannot be fully appreciated without discussion of Adventism as a social system. So there's much to be appreciated about the section on theology, but it's sociological from beginning to end. I get the impression that the conclusions are slightly slanted in favor to foster the seeking a sanctuary image, rather than, I would say, giving the what I would call a true picture of Adventism, and that one should fall back upon this sort of eschatological great controversy theme in the basis of a broader Arminian theology, which places a great deal of emphasis upon the incarnation as well as upon the atonement and the cross, on sanctification, which derives from the theosis of the incarnation model within that broader concept of theology, that more could be done to define a defining Adventist theological system than we have in these very useful chapters. So I've overspent my time, so.
I read this book in the 80s when it came out, and then here's the new edition, suddenly out, can it be, how many years, 16 years later? Time for a new edition? What could they possibly add to this book? So I'm reading Gary Land's book review on the Spectrum website, and I can't believe what I'm reading. And I go back and I read this paragraph again. Adventism is a feminist church, a feminine church? What? I gotta go find Gary Land. I gotta go talk to him about this. I gotta talk to somebody about this. So I buttonholed him in the hallway of Nethery and I said, Gary, Adventism is a feminist church? A feminine church? What? He said, we had a little chat and he said, oh, well, I've got to run off to class. So I said, Gary, we have to talk about this book sometime, someplace on this campus. I couldn't believe this. I mean, here I am, a lifetime Adventist woman, and I'm reading that Adventism is called feminine in the context of the norms of Western culture. Now, I'm going to be reporting here. I'm a communicator, so I'm not going to interpret it. I'm going to report. You decide, all right? Adventists, like docile women, remain quiet, malleable, and do not seek to draw attention to themselves for fear of hostile reaction, that persecution complex that you heard him refer to. This is their words I'm reporting. This is not Gary's words. I'm reporting their words, Bull and Lockhart. No, I'm not implicating Gary. So in American society, they argue, Adventism occupies a feminine position. And immediately they bring in the Mormons and say, hey, the Mormon church started at the same time. And look, it was started by men, and look what happened to them. They're polygamists, and look, they have these celestial heavens, and women don't have any kind of status. But look at Adventism. Because it was started by a woman, we value feminine qualities of education and nurture and medicine and healing. And so that, I had never thought of that before. Then they discussed that James White began arguing in 1858 in print that Adventism prophecy, there must have been a little, you know, can a woman be a prophet here? So he defended her and he said that it's an equal opportunity career. Well, the authors trace how women fared in the last century, and there was an emphasis on equality for women. They featured prominently in this new movement with this new vision, and they refer to other researchers who say that in new social movements, women are often one of the leaders, and they are often part of establishing a movement, and then they served. Excuse me. So in Adventism, they served as licensed ministers, Bible workers on equal terms, husband and wife, evangelistic teams. They were administrative officers. And then the church also, they say, introduced this feminized version of fatherhood. You know, not this. It was a new version of fatherhood in society, that men should be fathers and maybe help take care of the children and so on. Apparently, in 1881, there was a resolution for women to be ordained, and Bull and Lockhart say we don't know what happened to it or why, but that early it actually came to the General Conference session. And about 1900, we started to see a focus on women's domestic duties. And Bull and Lockhart say that our church trailed the American culture in focusing on women's, uplifting women, where Mrs. White wrote that the duties of a woman are maybe more holy than even those of a man and so on, those kinds of statements. But in 1902, half of the educational department leaders were women, One-third of conference treasurers were women, one-third of conference secretaries were women, and two-thirds of the Sabbath school officers were women. And then 15 years later, there was this huge decline, and men started filling these positions. So we're starting to read in Adventist literature that women are the preferred sex. Mothers are holy, their contribution are, you know, very valued within the home. And the male part, Bull and Lockhart say that the men actually, you know, that we don't eat red meat, we don't have competitive sports, and, you know, it's sort of an emasculated church in a way, because it's not a place where there's a lot of expression or opportunities for men to express their manhood. So back in the 70s, when the women's movement started coming in, Bull and Lockhart say that the male leadership responded coolly to the feminist movement, and they prevented full participation of women in the church. And then they mention the Mary Kay Silver, that they devote several paragraphs to that. And then they jump to one of the things that they've updated in the second edition is this 2005 General Conference session in St. Louis, where women were entirely excluded from holding the highest office when the Constitution was changed to say that only an ordained person could be elected General Conference President. And so, interestingly, unlike Mormonism, unlike other mainline Protestant churches, our church, Seventh-day Adventism, has the highest census of women. In the first edition, it says women outnumber men 2-1. In the new edition, it says 3-1. And I think the research that I've read says as high as 70% of the Adventist church is women. I think that's probably all I'm going to say for now, except to close with this very interesting statement, and that is that men, because this is a feminine organization, the only channels open to men were the creation and maintenance of the bureaucracy of the church. So they could take the bureaucracy and they could control it, and that would be through institutional structures, the place where they could exhibit their manliness. If women were allowed to participate fully, men would have no place to play masculine roles in Adventism, according to Bull and Lockhart. And they say that the particular complexities within Adventism reflect the ambiguities inherent in Adventism itself.
Well, I've been asked to look at this book through a historical perspective, and discussing with Gary his introduction yesterday, I kept emphasizing to him this is not a history book. It's very interdisciplinary. It contains a considerable amount of history, but it's not fundamentally a historical work. The first part, which Russell described in a fair amount of detail, is the most historical section of the book. Each chapter is basically a history of the particular topic of that chapter. When you get into the other two parts of the book, the chapters are largely organized around contemporary Adventism, and then the history is brought in at various points to explain contemporary Adventism. The book is based on a great deal of research. Historians always want to look at primary sources, that is, the material written by the people who made the history, and there's quite a bit of use of primary sources in this book, particularly with regard to early Adventism. And there's very extensive acquaintance with secondary literature, both about Adventism and about American religion and American society that's brought in to develop their argument with regard to Adventism. So I don't think there's anything that can be said critically with regard to with their research. It's an extensively researched book. Their thesis is not really what we would call a historical thesis, that is an argument about how Adventism has developed and changed over time, but rather it's a thesis about the nature of Adventism, and I think that reflects the sociological approach, the social science approach that they have here. They've got two, in my view, two intertwining theses. One, Adventism provides an alternative means of achieving the American dream of spiritual fulfillment and material progress. And secondly, Adventism remains a sect. It is not transforming from sect to denomination. They take issue with that argument. But these, are not primarily historical arguments. They are arguments concerned with the nature of contemporary Adventism. Now, in looking at the book and some of what I'm going to say here will be repetitive if you read the review that I wrote for the Spectrum website, and then, to my surprise, also it appeared in print. I didn't know I was going to do that. But one of the elements that struck me in reading the book, I don't think it struck me the first time when I read the first edition, but when I read the second edition and took a lot of notes because I was going to write a review of it, and going over the notes, was the considerable attention they give to what I call the dialectics of Adventism, opposing elements, things that are in tension within Adventism, that they believe then helps shape the nature of this movement. They're primarily concerned with these internal dynamics. And let me just mention a few of them. Some of these have already been mentioned in another context. One would be the Bible is the source of Adventist belief, but Ellen White is the final interpreter of the Bible. The hope for the second coming versus concern about the delay in the second coming. Identity as an Adventist is identified with specific beliefs versus identity as an Adventist versus loyalty to organizational structure. The Arian elements that they believe they find in the sanctuary doctrine, which of course was formed by people who were largely Arian, versus Trinitarianism, a tension they don't think has been resolved. When you turn to Adventism as a social system, what Pam just mentioned, the church is opposed to traditional male values of competition, control, and things like that, but at the same time provides a bureaucracy whereby males can exercise those very values. It's a church characterized by a considerable degree of ethnic diversity, but at the same time continues to practice a form of segregation, regional conferences being a primary example in there. It's a church that has a very powerful denominational bureaucracy, but at the same time also has a very powerful health system that operates in some ways independently and in tension with that denominational bureaucracy. And then the one that's probably the most interesting is the purest form of Adventism, in terms of its values and beliefs and so forth, is found in the self-supporting movement, which is outside of the control of the denominational structure. In other words, if you work within the denominational structure, you can't purely express, at least not easily, the very elements of Adventism. So those are interesting dynamics, and let me just read you one passage. I should have read this a little bit earlier. This is in the review that I wrote, but how they kind of pull some of these elements together. The thesis of Adventist radicalism, I'm talking now in terms of this dialectic, which you got this thesis, antithesis, synthesis, the kind of textbook description of Marxism. I don't think the book is Marxist in any way. I'm not trying to suggest that. But they do use this triad of thesis, antithesis, synthesis without using any of those labels. The thesis of Adventist radicalism produced the antithesis of fundamentalism, out of which came the synthesis of evangelicalism. That's what they argue, basically. But that's not the end of the argument. However, and in keeping with the argument that Adventism is not progressing to denominational status, as this synthesis, that is, of evangelicalism, became the new thesis, the antithesis that it produced was a return to fundamentalism rather than a step to a higher stage of development. And then the question would be, well, what's the new synthesis going to be? But that's the way in which they see the denomination developing, and through these internal contradictions. Some concluding observations. One that I've stated already a couple of times, they approach Adventism, despite their attention to history, primarily as a social organism shaped largely by its internal dynamics. Their argument that Adventism is still a sect versus the argument that it's transforming into denomination, I think has validity in some respects, but I don't think it's a full description. It depends, I think, on what aspects of the church you're talking about. You know, right now, Andrews University is working very hard on preparing for accreditation from the North Central. And, you know, we have to do all kinds of things that are set by people outside of us because we want to be a, you know, a valid and respected institution. That's not very sect-like that we're concerned with that. So I think, you know, it's true for certain elements, but I think there's other elements that that don't fit that model and that that may better fit the move from sect to denomination. A major question that I would have, this is not a criticism, but just a question. This book is primarily about North American Adventism, almost entirely. It gives you some statistics, comparative statistics about other parts of the world, but doesn't really say anything about other parts of the world. It's about North American Adventism. The question is, what happens to this North American Adventism as it's transported to other parts of the world? We've had references made to, you know, what happens when Adventism becomes a majority. We have far more people active in the political systems of other countries than we do here in this country. There must be a different kind of mentality at work. And so I think an interesting question would be what happens with some of these values, some of these ideas, or this ideology as they describe it, as it's moved into other cultural contexts outside of us. The final comment I'd make, and this is primarily a comment on the first edition, as I have been surprised, because I'm one of those who believe that this is probably the best single book on Adventism, despite the fact that, you know, might have criticism of certain points. Despite the fact that it is such an important work on Adventism, I have not detected that it's had much impact upon Adventist scholarship. And one example, and I haven't kept track of this, so this is an impression. I've seen a number of reference books that have sections on Adventism, some of which are written by, you know, or most of which are written by Adventist professors, and they will have bibliographies. This book seldom shows up in those, except for the ones I've written, and for whatever significance that has. But it usually doesn't show up, and I'd say why. And then I don't think anybody has dealt with the interpretive elements of it and incorporated that into other work on Adventism. So I hope that the second edition will be given more attention by Adventist scholars. Thank you.
The subtitle of this book is Seventh-day Adventism and the American Dream. And I would like to say just a few words about the American Dream to set in context, I think, what it is that is so important to this argument. And I agree with Gary, this is a sociological study of the nature of Adventism. The nature of Adventism within the broader context of American society. So what is the American Dream that we are in some way in relationship to? Well, this is the dream that an individual can come to this country and have the opportunity and the freedom to become a citizen and to live, become the artist of their own life without having to be confined by existing structures. It is the possibility of inventing one's own life, so to speak. And so that's why people come to America. They want the freedom to fulfill their lives, to have free lives. They don't want to be confined by religious structures. And in this country, they see that freedom. Now, in chapter, I think it's chapter 13. I know it's chapter 13 in the old volume, which is one I have, the first volume. He specifically addresses this relationship between Adventism and religion. And he refers to the American civil religion. What is the American civil religion? It is really that America, as he says here, that American society is a means to universal redemption. It's the notion that the American vision, our system of government that gives people individual freedom to pursue their lives in liberty, this is applicable universally. So America, in a sense, is exceptional in history, and it is universally applicable. Now, to me, it's really interesting, then, that the main argument of this book is that Adventism is essentially not about this. It is not about American universalism, nor is it about, really, the American dream in the sense of it being applicable to the whole world. Because for Adventism, in fact, we, as Dr. Staples pointed out, we preach that this very America is going to turn on us. The Sunday laws are going to limit our freedoms. And so we, in fact, have a very different message that we espouse than is part of the American dream. So we are really a very counter-revolutionary movement. And here, then, I just read from a little section from this chapter. The church and its institutions are the Adventist home. America is, to some degree, a foreign land. Its institutions are familiar, but familiar through resemblance to their Adventist counterparts, not through direct contact. In its efforts to exempt itself from American time, a time bounded by annihilation, while forced to share American space, Adventism has recreated America within America. It has turned the ideology of civil religion inside out to form a faith that consigns the nation to damnation and locates salvation within another social group, a group defined by the seventh-day Sabbath, inspired by the ideals that reinterpret fundamental American values. Now, this is very interesting, because while we are a counter-movement, at the same time, they argue, we are an accelerated, we are a shortcut to the American dream. You bring people into Adventism, they don't spend their money on alcohol or on jewelry. There are great educational opportunities, and you put all these things together, and suddenly you advance faster toward the American dream, in terms of material wealth. And yet, the very thing that we then bring them into is in conflict with the overall American society. And so no wonder the last chapter is called the revolving door, because we bring people in, they get an accelerated move into the American dream, only to discover that that dream, in fact, runs counter to the majority hope. And so people exit from our church. And so we have the revolving door. So I think that as a study, just one final point. So how do Adventists then manage to live in this contradiction? And of course, we do so by having, we put a great deal of emphasis on living sort of quietly as in rebellion to the main argument. We are very good at that, apparently. But I think I'll stop there, and we can perhaps continue the discussion on the panel and also, for sure, with the audience.
Let's go to your questions, if you have any, and if you don't have any, I don't know, I'll ask them about human growth hormones or something. I don't know. Make like a congressional hearing.
I would like to know more about the background of the authors, because I think that's critical to understanding where they're coming from and where they're heading. What is their connection with Adventism? What are their biases, their prejudices? Are they generally friendly to Adventism? Those kind of questions about the authors.
I talked a little bit about that at the beginning. They were both raised within the Adventist culture, both educated a little bit, at least within Adventist schools. But they seem to have left Adventism. As far as practice is concerned, Keith Lockhart is quoted as saying they didn't really have any agenda in approaching writing this book. They didn't have a specific axe to grind or anything like that.
I think that the book, while, you know, in a sense it has criticisms of Adventism, it's not written as a hostile work at all.
No, it's sympathetic.
The criticisms would be, you know, the kind that any kind of scholar might make of a subject of which he's not a part. It's a very sympathetic study of Adventism. There's nothing hostile about it.
Obviously, this is a book I've got to read yet, but I suspect that the research was completed about 3 or 4 years ago, right? Yes. Now, I'd like to know whether they remark or whether you have a remark to make about the fact that the sect denominational church kind of typology breaks down with the black church. It occurs to me that the appointment of Barry Black as the Senate chaplain and John Sweet, president of the mayor of Philadelphia, figures like Wentley Phipps and Dr. Carson and so forth, are not sectarian figures. And I wonder if it's no coincidence that they're all African Americans. Is there a kind of a two-tone church here?
I do know that from talking to Brian Wilson, the last conversation I had, that he didn't quite know how to cope for this Adventist upward mobility, economically and politically, the weight they had. And he described he traveled the world widely in considering sects. And this ran counter to his sect-like theory that Adventists would work up and have this weight. I can remember him telling about meeting people of prominence in both Papua New Guinea and in several countries in Africa. Your other question relating to African Americans in this country, I don't know.
I don't know how relevant this would be, but just something that I thought of with regard to that. Doug Morgan, who's a historian, teaches at CUC, is doing work on Louis B. Schieff, who was the pastor of Black Church in Washington, D.C. in the early part of the 20th century. And that, eventually the church came into tension with the denomination and left. But it was actually drawing from the black elite of Washington, D.C., because it was the denomination was seen as a place where blacks could do something on their own. Obviously, some things have changed since then, but there may be, I hadn't thought of that idea, but there may be something to that the what you call the two-tone church and its relationship to the sectarian issue.
The book also mentions women who worked. It's in the section on gender about Mrs. White's concern for the African Americans in the South, and Edson, I think, also worked there in Nashville, and the purchasing of the Madison Farm and so on, and the work for African Americans who also were probably not too long after slavery, you know, without their own means and just starting to scramble to make a living, and how Adventism, they also were able to buy into this American dream.
Just a quick note before the comment I want to make, because somebody asked about the background. Keith Lockhart did earn an MA in religion here at Andrews University. He is still a vegetarian and does not use tobacco or alcohol, but he's not currently a practicing member of the church. He has no hostility toward the church, though. I had the privilege of reviewing this book for Andrews University Seminary Studies, due to come out at the next edition when it comes out. So there are a lot of comments I could make, but I realize the time situation, and I'd just like to comment on this major theme about the fact that the sect-like opportunity, staying away from government and the American dream. It's hard to question the facts in this book. It's, as has been mentioned, it's exhaustively researched. There are 89 pages of endnotes. The book itself is 500 pages long. It took me a long time to work through it and to try to digest what was in there. But well, you probably wouldn't dispute the facts. You can argue with some of the interpretations. And I thought that it may be a true more in the past of Adventist sectarian notion and withdrawal from government. But there are things, it seemed to me, that point out that the picture might be changing somewhat. And I noted we could talk about the presence of communication specialists at all levels that work to present the denomination in the most favorable light to the public. As the authors point out, more Adventists are running for public office, with individuals serving in Congress as governor and as mayor and important positions in government agencies, although the authors do mention that that's much more common in other countries. The church, I think is important, has dropped its insistence on non-combatancy in military service, supporting enlistment of members and bearing of arms. That has been a major change toward government. And to me, one of the most significant things is that today's evangelists tend to downplay the identification of the second beast of Revelation 13. If you've listened to any evangelistic meetings, they do not sound like evangelistic meetings used to a long time ago. The original thing is based on the, nobody's mentioned this yet, the 1851 article by J.N. Andrews identifying the second beast of Revelation with the United States was the fundamental thing that got this all started. But that seems to be waning, it seems to me. And I from my perspective, it looks to me like the church is moving more toward denominationalism away from their sectarian past.
I have an interesting perspective. I work with the law enforcement individuals, and Dwayne McBride and I had a discussion about a month ago dealing with the two cases that came before the court system locally here with Andrews University personnel on trial, and both were convicted and were sent away to prison or jail. What was interesting to me was the letter-writing campaign that took place here on the campus in support of these individuals who both clearly had done wrong. I know about one of the incidences very well because I'm on good terms with the prosecutor in that particular case. And he informed me about the letter-writing campaign on the part of this traffic crash individual. And what was interesting to me was that one of the professors on the campus offered to do the jail time or prison time for the student who was convicted. And my curiosity to Dwayne was, why? why would such a statement be made? Because there is absolutely no chance that it's going to be accepted. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because Duane's response is obviously based in this book. His response was that we have a parallel system. And I believe that the judge in this case might have indeed picked up on the fact that he was being dissed by this professor, basically arguing that you don't have a right to try this case since an Adventist killed Adventists in this particular car crash. And the result was, from my point of view, most interesting because the prosecutor felt as though the judge issued a harsher sentence than the prosecutor would have been happy with. So what I'm trying to say is I'm supporting the concept of a parallel system and how at times it may actually work against us when we diss individuals who have the ability to put the hurt on us.
Okay, Greg, and then we'll go. While I'm flattered that my name appears in print in his book and the drawing is in there, I think that they missed the motive for the book that they really wanted to talk about or they featured. I think they were impressed by the, like maybe all Englishmen are, impressed more that by the fact that two of my books were published by an English publisher, and they featured that instead of my Jesus of New York book, which I can't get published. But they missed the point. You know, when they interviewed me, I gave them a very clear concept of what inspired me to do that book, and they didn't mention it at all, so... Maybe I need to have an objective reading, somebody outside of myself to read the paragraph on my contribution, because I don't see it.
I'd like to ask the panel a question. They make an argument in this book that Adventism is really about time and not space and not about the visual arts, surely. Any of you like to comment on that? And how does that square with seeking a sanctuary, which is physical space, whether it's here or heavenly? Do they have that right?
Well, I think, you know, they in that connection, they contrast Adventists and Mormons in the last chapter. And for the Mormons, the sanctuary is a space, but for Adventism, it's the Sabbath. So the Sabbath, in fact, is one of the ways that we maintain a parallel community.
And that's very good. To add to that is also the eschatological theme of Adventism. This has been a powerful driving force no matter where you do. Even you go to Africa today, where in places we are in some places the largest church, it's still an eschatologically driven church. And it's the concern of proclaiming the gospel to all the world and then the end will come. That's part of the motif. The motivating force that has sort of guided the church and in motivated it to do these kinds of things.
Just adding a little bit to the background, Keith also did his undergrad work here, and I think it was all 4 years of communication major. He was a very good friend of our girls, classmates, or in between or something. And I remember Robin Willis and Rick Kajura. There was a little group that ran around together. He was lots of fun, and it came down to our house often. And when he came back to do research, he came there. And it was 6 years ago that he came, and I took him up to Battle Creek and introduced him to some people he wanted to see and get some pictures. And there was one time when we were in London in, was it, 89, I think, and... I was, anyway, Bob was teaching, and I went into the Independent to look him up. And I had to smile because the fellow at the front desk, kind of a guard there, when he found out who I was and why I was there, he kind of grinned and he said, "Well, you're a friend of Keith, you know him well?" I said, "Yes." "Well, then," he said, "you'll understand, we don't see him very often, and I have no idea where he is." So,
It sounds to me, I haven't read the book, obviously, but that one of the major themes that comes out of this that sort of looks like a criticism is that Adventism separates itself from the world to some degree or another, and that that creates a sectarian sort of view of Adventism, and they view us as missing a graduation or a step to another level in moving towards denominationalism. And my question is for the panel, because each of you come from different perspectives, do you believe that moving in the direction of denominationalism from their perception of sectarianism is a good thing, and if so, why?
Well, I think that what has given us our raison d'être is our theology. And to the extent that we keep alive a theology that, in a sense, is counter to the American dream, we will remain a sect. But by the same token, I don't really think most college students here see themselves as really being part of a counter theology. I don't know that they have that awareness. And so that's why maybe we have a lot of cultural Adventists who haven't really bought into the theology of it. And even though the earlier comments about maybe we are just backing off of that, I still hear sermons that even today at PMC, the sermon was about the Sabbath, a very crucial part of keeping us separate.
There are no accusations against another.
No, but nevertheless, we are very clear about that.
Just one thing that occurs to me in response to that question. Probably the issue would be not so much is it good or bad, but rather what is the relationship to the larger society? Do we simply retreat into our own little enclave, or do we work to transform that society? And I think Adventism has elements of both. If in that process of becoming a denomination we lose all tension with the larger society, then obviously we've lost something of our our reason for being. I think at least most people I would talk to and students would, I think, prefer to see, yes, we're going to have major differences from the society. We're going to be a counterculture, so to speak, but not a counterculture that lives in an enclave, but rather one that seeks to change that society. Just one thought in connection with what Greg said. I've heard you say a number of times that when somebody paints a painting, you lose ownership of it, and it goes out there, and people do with it what they want. And I guess that's what's happened here. It may not be what you intended, but it's the way they see it. You don't have control over it.
I think this relates in a certain sense to the retention of identity. And so I've seen the church, which is almost the major church in a certain place. The two things I think that maintain identity when it has long since been a sect is Sabbath does this, but then eschatology does as well. It conforms us, we are living coram Deo. God is in control, he will come. The great controversy theme feeds into that. And so I see the strong identity remaining. We don't fade out into just a secularism or some sort of a broadly based agnosticism. The Sabbath, God is of time, eschatology, giving this identity. Maybe it's a step toward fulfilling the purposes of the Adventist Church. And certainly, the growth of the Adventist Church is so rapid that it's, I think it's, this is what unseated Brian Wilson from his program. He didn't quite know how to cope with this growth into the church all over the place with his, he was a specialist in sects, the doyen of all scholars on sects, as it was. I had something else, but that's...
Okay.
Just a brief commentary on one section of the book that dealt with the history of our scientific work in geoscience. I was a participant in the early part of that work, and something that didn't come out in this work, as I understand it, is that the three of us who were characterized as, quotes, liberal in the church were the only three at that time who were specially trained in our areas of expertise. P. Edgar Hare began with his study of amino acids in geochemistry. Ed Lugenbeil and I came later. Ed Lugenbeil training in prehistory. One of the things that they characterize again is that we were the, quotes, liberal, and contrasting that with the conservative groups. And it seems to me that it would be helpful to be a little more specific there. I think their basic treatment of the timing was good and the personnel, but the questions that were coming up, I think we would have liked to ask, what do we do with inconvenient data? These data that we were having to deal with were surprises to Hare and me. Hare was stunned when he found out what amino acids were doing relative to carbon-14. He did not anticipate the results he got. I was stunned in geology. And we would have liked to ask, what do we do with inconvenient data? What is the nature of science in these areas? The implications are huge for many of our ideas about both the past and the future for the Earth. And we were wanting to try and deal with those things. Eventually, all three of us took vacations from institutional employment.
I'd just make one comment, not on the content of what you said, but it's a little bit disconcerting when one sees your name, at least for me, in placed in a historical context in a book. It's I'm used to reading about people that either I don't know or that lived a long time ago, and it doesn't bother me. But when I see my own name and Hal talking about, you start thinking of yourself as being part of some sort of a historical movement, however minor it might have been. It's a little bit disconcerting about one's concept of time, shall we say?
But you've published 4 or 5 books on Adventism, or more maybe, so this is not surprising at all.
Yeah, but just to think of yourself as a historical figure, then start putting yourself in the past tense, that's a little troubling.
I think one of the most interesting chapters is the chapter on academics and the tension between thinkers and then the pressure of our religious, our denomination, the expectations, the interesting tightrope that academics have sometimes walked, as he very articulately described. That chapter is very fascinating to read.
I had the privilege of being at Newbold in the mid-80s, which is when Keith Lockhart was there and was a friend of his during that time. And I think it's fair to say, even though he was teaching part-time at Newbold at the time, he was even then pretty skeptical of the spirit of prophecy and traditional Adventist views. And while I agree there's not an axe to grind in the book, I think you can sort of hear silent cheering as the church moves away from certain traditional positions and towards more mainstream positions. Having said that, I think the book works and is very excellent because, at least in its factual observations, and I think the authors illustrate what is important about the beast of Revelation 13, which is the tension between lamb-likeness and dragon-likeness. And while maybe we're used to this and we don't think about it, it's pretty profound. It means you're not going to be ultimately loyal, neither are you going to be ultimately hostile. You're going to have a kind of a critical distancing that goes with your loyalty. And it's been very important for Adventists. Otherwise, I think we'd be on the far right wing of the religious right now. And my question is, as we grow as a world church, this critical distancing becomes all the more important that as 90% of our members are overseas in other countries, that we here in America not be seen as sort of hand in glove with our government and all its policies. What are the implications for us as a worldwide church if in fact
we lose, has been suggested, the power of this very sophisticated image in Revelation 13, and we move to a more uncritical, perhaps, loyalty and mainstream insight. What happens to the worldwide church if that happens?
Well, I think it's a very well-stated question, and one of the things that just comes to mind is that it seems that the idea of Adventism accelerating people to a higher level of socioeconomic life is happening all around the world. I'm just now writing the preface for a book that has been written by Hector Diaz. It's a collection of essays that look, well, actually it's a co-authored book, where he looks at what happens with wherever ADRA goes. ADRA builds social capital, and you have all these benefits occurring. And I guess my concern is that, looking, for example, at ADRA, ADRA has been very keen to stay separate from the church theologically and evangelistically in order to do its work. And I'm Dutch. I know that Dr. Staples has been referring back to his concern that the book doesn't really highlight the ecclesiastical driver behind Adventism. But my sort of suspicion is that we started with a eschatological driver, but we have created a sociological system that works very well. The question is, it's essentially restating your question, will it continue to work without the eschatological driver? And I don't know.
What you have said is a very minor part of the great controversy theme, which we have maintained, and particularly in an American thing which is not so much emphasized everywhere else overseas, but have maintained. And I think decreasingly overseas it's thought of as an American church. And so that fades away. Your concern, which we have here, fades away. And the concern is to be a truly faithful Adventist church, faithful to the gospel in every kind of respect, and so on.
This hasn't been mentioned so far here this afternoon, but it relates to something that Nick said. And that is the authors of this book. One of the things they use to support the idea that we're still in the sectarian idea is the rather strong right-wing or fundamentalist emphasis on some of the groups more fringy, let's say, to the thing. For instance, they give an example, the organization of the Adventist Theological Society, the publication of Adventist Affirm, the official statement voted by the General Conference on the proper interpretation of Scripture, which rejects historical critical methods, the International Board to Control Theological Education, the opposition to the ordination of women, and very active fringe conservative groups. They also made a point concerning the replacement of liberal professors at the theological seminary by a more conservative group under the deanship of Gerhard Hassel. So those are some things they pointed out, as that it kind of makes you think that there must be two Adventist churches. You know, you have the one side that is more denominational and the other side that is more sectarian.
And you have the rest.
I think that we've raised a lot of questions, but I think we better stop there. And for those of you who haven't read the book, when it snows 6 inches and it's down to 10 degrees, I recommend to you what I tell my students. Don't complain about southwestern Michigan weather. Get a good book, stay inside, and read it. And this is a good book. Stay inside and read it. Let's thank our panel for...